Dr. Hoffman here. This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Super Beats. I personally take Super Beats when I need a power boost. It's my favorite product. Super Beats gives me energy and stamina for my busy day. Right now, get a one-month supply free with your first order. Check out the Dr. Hoffman special right now at intelligentbeats.com. That's intelligentbeats.com. Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin, who is duly credentialed as a registered dietitian, but also possesses an advanced master's degree in the field of nutrition. Together, we see patients at the Hoffman Center, and we're here today to answer your questions. I'll remind you that if you want to send us a question, radioprogram@AOL.com is the place to send the question, radioprogram@AOL.com. And Layla, what do we got?
Okay, Adrian writes in, do you think boron should be in a multivitamin? Isn't it estrogenic? Shouldn't it be avoided by women with estrogen dominance, uterine fibroids, hormone-driven cancers? And there's a second part to this question. Will trimethylglycine and choline adversely impact my cholesterol levels?
Okay.
The second part I never heard. Yeah.
Two completely different questions.
Yeah.
So is boron estrogenic? And we do know this.
I've seen it in bone health supplements.
Yeah, it's in bone health supplements.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, how does it exert its action? Does it work like estrogen to increase bone density? Because indeed, if it did, what it would do is it would possibly increase the risk for uterine cancer, breast cancer. And if it raised testosterone, well, that might be good. But for men with prostate cancer, that could be a problem. So this all dates back to a study that was done in the 1980s that has to do with the effect of dietary boron on estrogen and testosterone. And what they found was that boron helped mineral metabolism. I'm looking at the study right now. And they say it markedly elevated the serum concentrations of 17 beta estradiol and testosterone, which is good in a way because that helps to slow bone loss, but could be problematic. And so, so what's the real deal? Well, this stuff has been around. Okay, 1987. We're talking. You know, we were listening to Duran Duran in 1987, right? It's
long,
a lot of water under the bridge. It's like how many years later?
27 years ago.
27 years ago, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Actually, I have not seen a lot to suggest to me that boron. Is potentially hazardous. I think boron works when you're deficient, you know, just like zinc. You know, some people say, well, take zinc to raise your testosterone. Well, if you take zinc and you have normal testosterone, it will do absolutely nothing. But if you're severely deficient in zinc, it may help to support, you know, your testosterone production. I think boron may have a role to play like that.
Right,
I don't think it dramatically increases the risk of cancer. Here's another one. This is a more recent one, okay? According to the authors of a study done, I think it was in 2010, boron had, quote, no major effect on hormone levels 6 hours after supplementation. They looked at testosterone, DHT, and estrogen. And so I think that boron is something that can help bone density. And it's in my – I put boron deliberately in my osteosupport, believing that it was safe – for all women to use. And I'm going to stick to my guns because, you know, there was some old research, and sometimes old research gets overturned. I think more recent research suggests that there's no harm and that boron is a bone-enhancing nutrient, but not something that raises testosterone or estrogen.
Yeah. So now, what do we think about trimethylglycine and choline adversely impacting cholesterol?
This is what it is. I know what they're talking about. There's this. Remember that thing about TMAO?
Yes.
Trimethylamine oxidase. The way I remember that is there's this thing on, you know, on Facebook. It's like LMAO. I laughed my something off, but
yes.
This is TMAO. So trimethyl. This is funny how I remember things. Trimethylamine oxidase is something that gets produced when you consume lots of choline or trimethylglycine, okay? And that is apparently a cardiovascular risk factor. And it's quite apart from cholesterol. This is a person a little confused. They got the part right about that it's a heart risk, but they confused it with cholesterol. Cholesterol is a separate and distinct heart risk. So if you have a high level of TMAO, just as if you have a bad cholesterol, you might be at higher risk for heart disease. That's what the study shows. So what they're saying, the inference is, don't take choline and don't take trimethylglycine. Well, that kind of runs counter to what we see in real life, because two of the major sources of choline in our diets are soy, and most studies suggest that soy, if anything, is heart healthy. That, I mean, whatever you may say about soy, you know, that it's allergenic, difficult to digest, that it damages the thyroid, nitrogen, that it's not natural, whatever, it's not paleo. It does seem to people on a high soy diet, they don't encounter more heart disease, and that delivers a lot of choline because soy is rich in choline. That's where, you know, when you buy choline, you know, you're going to get mostly soy-derived choline. So that's number one. Number two, the other major source of choline in our diet is from fish. And in fact, if you ever buy straight choline, you know, it smells like fish. It's stinky, like fish. Mm-hmm. And that's it's actually what is, to some extent, responsible for the smell, the fishy smell of fish. So to say that eating too much choline or having, you know, that's not, and that thereby raising the TMAO, that's bad for your heart, that's not been demonstrated. It's sort of like taking fragmentary science and applying a theory to it. Mm-hmm. What also appears to be the case in an article in the New England Journal of Medicine is that your likelihood of getting your choline or your TMG to turn in, and by the way, carnitine was implicated in this too, remember?
Yes.
Carnitine was also part of what, exactly. And that we know that carnitine is heart healthy for the most part.
Yep.
But in the study, it did make more TMAO. But here's the rub. It only did that in certain individuals, and it had to do with their intestinal flora, the bacteria in their intestines. So if you have the wrong bacteria in your intestine, you get that conversion. And if you have good bacteria, you don't. So it's complicated, and it suggests that if you have balanced intestinal flora, that won't happen. And they even went so far in that article in New England Journal of Medicine. Of course, they're going to go this route. They're going to say, well, we should invent an antibiotic that gets rid of the bacteria that converts the choline to TMAO. And then we have
another antibiotic.
No, we give that a statin and then an antibiotic to everybody to reduce the risk of heart disease, right? But, you know, that's going to end badly. So, okay, so TMG is really important because another word for TMG is betaine, as you know, Layla. Mm-hmm. And what does betaine do for us?
It helps to convert homocysteine back to methionine.
Right, perfect.
And it's interesting, you know, Adrian, her last sentence says, I don't know if my homocysteine is high, but I don't want to lower it at the risk of worsening my cholesterol.
I think she's got her priorities wrong. She's got it mixed up. It's not about cholesterol. It's about TMAO.
Yeah.
So I don't know how she got there. I mean, maybe hopefully she didn't read that somewhere because that's just plain wrong.
Right, right. And you want to be concerned about homocysteine because that's an independent risk factor for cardiovascular disease, stroke, dementia, and bone fracture. Oh, my. 4 for 4. Who needs that?
Right. And I don't always start with TMG in patients who have high homocysteine. I start with a supplement called Methylguard, which is activated tetrahydrofolate, five-methylfolate, the methylated folate, not folic acid, and methylated B12, along with vitamin B6. I think in the form of P5P, the pyridoxal 5-phosphate. So it's a premium form of methylating agents that lowers homocysteine. And then we can add the betaine. Betaine can help move that along. And you need large amounts of betaine, like 2-3 grams to move the needle on homocysteine if it's high.
Yeah. Okay, Adrian, we hope that answers your question.
Yep.
Okay. The next question comes from a pharmacist named Joseph. Hi, Layla. Hope all is well with you and Dr. Hoffman and others down at your practice. Thanks for all that you do for us. I'm confused here. Are there many differences in indole-3 carbonyl and DIM, diindole methane? I know that indole-3 carbonyl gets metabolized to DIM, but which one should I recommend to which people? Thanks in advance. Look forward to hearing.
Okay. Well, this is something that's been going on for a long time. It's there's a war going on in nutritional medicine. I've bitterly fought controversy between the proponents of DIM versus the proponents of I3C. and I actually, which is like, I mean, these people will vigorously debate this. And most of the people who are very excited about this have a proprietary interest in one product or another that's their product.
Aren't they both good?
I think so. And you can hedge your bets by taking a combination product that has a bit of both. I use a product called DIM Pro, which is the DIM. What is it? It's got the word indole in it. Indoles refer to compounds found in the broccoli family.
Diindole methane, right.
Right. It's diindole methane, or the other one is indole 3-carbonyl, I3C. And there's slightly different compounds. I3C gets metabolized into DIM. So you would, you know, it's an appealing notion that DIM is really the business end of that, and that I3C may be less efficacious. So, you know, however, I'm open to the possibility that I3C does fine. And, you know, let's talk a little bit about broccoli. There are actually a couple of major compounds that come out of broccoli. One, you know, the I3C and the DIM are cancer-fighting, but they're also hormonally regulating. So when we have women who have estrogen dominance, we'll give them DIM. There's some good studies on DIM versus cervical cancer, potentially useful against breast cancer. And so it's a good thing. Also, there's interesting studies on DIM for vocal polyps, you know, singers' polyps. Check it out because and it may have an anti-HPV effect, human papillomavirus. So so that's the story on that. But there's another set of very nice compounds that come from cabbage family vegetables, broccoli and Brussels sprouts. Yeah, go ahead.
Sulforaphane.
Yeah. SGS. And this is the work of Paul Talalay at Johns Hopkins University. You know, these days when you work for a university as your professor, you get a lot of financial backing, but then you invent something and the university owns the patent. So basically Johns Hopkins, which is a very respectable university, very scientifically conservative and medically straight, owns a patent on broccoli sprouts, which you can actually buy. It's a special type of sulforaphane glucosinolate-enriched sprouts. But also from that, you can derive a product called BroccoMax, which is rich in sulforaphane glucosinolate. And it's well-researched that this has anti-cancer properties. So we put our cancer patients on that. It's great for prostate cancer, breast cancer, you know, gastrointestinal cancers, you know, good stuff.
Great.
And well documented. Yeah, well documented.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
We have time for
our next
another
question. We have one more. Great.
Yep.
This comes from Brian. Dear Dr. Hoffman, I've been listening to your program on WOR via podcast while walking for the past 10 years.
Awesome.
I love the balanced approach to medicine you bring.
Great.
You are so informative and helpful to those you serve. God bless you for it.
Well, that's very kind. That's, yeah. I mean, like, it just really tickles me when it's meaningful for people out there because, you know, we sit here and I'm, you know, sitting here sort of in isolation staring at a microphone and who knows if anybody out there gives a hoot or is listening in it. And obviously, these podcasts provide information to a lot of people and enrich a lot of people's lives. So that's great to hear the feedback. Keep it coming.
Yeah.
Encourages us.
Well, Brian says, my sister has just been diagnosed with Paget's disease.
Okay.
No family history that we know of. I've never heard you address this ailment. Any advice you could share would be much appreciated. Thanks.
Yeah, Paget's disease is a disease of the bone, which is a mysterious disease. And what it does is it causes a lot of bone malformations so that the bone takes on like a Swiss cheese appearance. And it actually, it's different than osteoporosis because this, let's say that the Swiss cheese holes are much bigger. Maybe in osteoporosis you get tiny or microscopic holes. In Paget's disease, you get what looks almost like a bubble-like appearance of the bone, and it grows aberrantly. And it can lead to fractures. It can lead to pain. And, you know, I got to say that I am really not sure what can be done on a nutritional front with Paget's disease. I haven't had a patient with Paget's disease come to see me specifically for that in my entire medical career. And I could do a, you know, brief search on it. I mean, often some of the same things that help osteoporosis help these conditions. But I don't want to, you know, I don't want to be facile and say, oh, yeah, you know, bone, okay, you know, give the usual things, calcium, magnesium, vitamin D, vitamin K2. You know, these things might be helpful, but I don't think there's a lot of studies that show that they have efficacy in Paget's disease in terms of, you know, the natural treatments. I mean, look, sometimes when you have a real stuck medical condition, you don't know what to do and there's no hope. You can apply general principles of a healthy diet and, you know, provide some of the right kind of supplements. But, you know, I have to say, you know, here I am even scanning this, you know, using the Google Journal of Medicine here, you know, as I do a Google search on Paget's disease natural treatments, and I don't see a heck of a lot of them.
Wow.
So I don't know if I don't really feel that it's likely that I'm missing the boat. The treatment, there's no treatment for it. The conventional treatment for it is with, you know, osteoporosis drugs, things like bisphosphonates. And sometimes they're given intravenous. And calcitonin can also be given. And, you know, ultimately it may require surgery. But there's no cure. It does say that vitamin D may be beneficial, but they're recommending a paltry dose. This is, I'm looking at the National Institutes of Health senior website.
No. You know, which what's the dose?
600 international units.
You know? Oh, no. Oh, no.
You know what? Yeah, so, I mean, it may well be that future studies will show that vitamin D is preventive of Paget's.
Yeah.
That people who get Paget's often were vitamin D deficient. But I got to tell you that I'm not that encouraged by high-dose vitamin D in a condition where sometimes the bone proliferates. You know, it's actually growing aberrantly. Huh. It's like a sort of
a... It's like a double-edged sword.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you might really build up bad bone with the vitamin D. You know, so I would, I'd make sure there's adequate. I wouldn't really pump that person super high doses of vitamin D.
Okay.
All right. So, you know, look, it all goes to show you that, you know, natural medicine is great, but we don't know everything. And there may not be a natural correlate for every condition.
As much as we would like there to be,
I would wish that
that
were the
life.
Case. Yeah. So,
yeah.
You know, what you're going to hear, and he said he appreciates our balanced approach here. Balanced approach means, you know, teach thy mouth to say, I do not know. That's an ancient aphorism of a physician of the Middle Ages, Maimonides, who was a religious scholar in Spain during the Golden Age when Jews lived alongside of Muslims in the south of Spain. And Maimonides taught and was a physician to the court of the caliph of the you know, the Islamic royalty. And he's one of his famous sayings that was attributed to him was, he taught his medical students, his young medical students, teach thy lips to say I do not know. Because in the history of medicine, we've been bedeviled with doctors who felt they knew and applied improper therapies just to do something. And that's just plain wrong. You know, it's just the history of medicine is rife with examples where aggressive treatments that didn't make sense or were inefficacious actually did patients a disservice. So we got to say, let's, you know, we don't know what to do under these circumstances. Let's not do a fancy dance
sometimes
unnecessarily.
Sometimes the smartest thing you can say. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
That's what I got to say. All right. So on that note, I don't know.
Yeah. There we go. Best of luck to Brian's sister.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. So we want to wish all our listeners a very happy Thanksgiving. May, you know, may your turkey be tasty, and may your family gathering and your social gathering with friends be enriching. And may you grab all those holiday bargains on Black Friday, because that's really what it's all about. I mean, it's getting the bargains.
Get some turkey and go shopping.
Go shopping, yeah. Right. And also, please check out our newsletter, because this week we're going to provide you with survival tips for the holidays, courtesy of drhoffman.com. Thanks very much for joining us. I'm Dr. Arnold Hoffman with Layla. Goodbye, Layla.
Take care, Dr. Hoffman.
Thanks for joining us. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.